You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
If you are someone who loves movies like I do, then I imagine there are certain movies that you will watch anytime, any place, meaning if you're flipping through the channels and this particular movie is on, you are going to watch it no matter where it is in the movie, no matter if you've seen it 10 times. For me, it's any of the Jason Bourne movies. I mean, Matt Damon against the entire CIA, you know, I'm just like, I'm in immediately. It's Ocean's 11. I'll watch that whenever. Great heist movie. It's The Godfather. I mean, come on. Great. Some of my greatest lines that run through my head come from The Godfather. And it's Shawshank Redemption. There's something about Shawshank Redemption that gets me every time. I will always watch it. Many of you know the story of Shawshank Redemption. Andy Dufresne is the main character, and he is in prison for killing his own wife, only he didn't do it, right? He's innocent. And now he's suffering in this awful place, this place where he doesn't belong, in this prison. And what makes Andy Dufresne an interesting character is that he finds a way, even though he doesn't belong there, he finds a way to thrive there, if you can call it thriving. In some ways, he changes the very culture of the prison because he doesn't live with despair. He doesn't live without hope. He actually lives with great hope, even though most people around him are not living with any hope. It's one of the most famous lines in the movie that Andy Dufresne says. Remember it? He says, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things. And I think that's why I love that movie, because I think Shawshank Redemption makes you feel hope in your bones, unlike hardly any story that I know. I feel hope. So Andy Dufresne is able to live and thrive in this place where he doesn't belong because he has hope, right? Hope is just a desirable vision of the future. It's this vision of the future in a way that we long for it, which is true about what we know about human nature. Like, whatever a person believes about the future shapes the way that they live now. Like, you want to know, why is a person living the way they are now? Well, just ask, what's driving them in the future? What are they living for? What are they placing their hope in? This fall, we are looking at this little letter called 1 Peter, and we started looking at it a couple of weeks ago. And right here, I don't know if you noticed at the beginning of the letter, Peter starts talking about the future. It's like he begins the letter with the end of the story in mind. And so he starts talking about the last times, the last day. He starts talking about when Jesus comes back someday. He talks about heaven. So he's pointing the readers ahead to the future right here at the beginning of the letter. Now, he's writing to these people he calls exiles. You see that in verse 1? We looked at that a couple of weeks ago. He says, you're exiles, literally, you're resident aliens. And what that means is, as Christians, We take up residence in a particular culture, but we're aliens to that culture. It's not our home country. Like, our home country is another country. It's really another kingdom. And so we live as residents in this place. And we are supposed to live in this place and give ourselves to this place and care about the good and the flourishing of this place. But it's not our home. It's not our home country. We're exiles. And because of that, Christians will seem foreign to any culture. The way we look at the world, the way we view the world will seem foreign to any culture, and we will receive hostility in varying degrees in any culture at any time in history because of the very things that we believe about the way life works. Because we believe crazy stuff, you know. Like, we believe that this book is authoritative. We bring our lives under the authority of this book because we say that God is speaking here. We believe crazy stuff like everything, I mean everything, hinges on the life, death, resurrection of a first century Jewish carpenter who claimed to be God. And most cultures, listen, have trouble trusting people who believe stuff like that and stake their lives on stuff like that. And so as Christians, no matter what culture we're in, our worldview is not the dominant worldview. Like, we are exiles just passing through on our way home. We're on a journey home, and the journey's going to be hard. To varying degrees, it's going to be hard because we will face hostility for what we believe and who we are. And so the question is, what's going to get us through the journey? Like, what's going to enable us to persevere in the journey when it gets really difficult? And Peter's answer for that is hope. A clear vision of a certain future is what he's saying we need. That's what Peter points us to right from the outset of the letter. Look at verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 3. Listen to what Peter says. He said, Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, why? Why do we bless him? Why do we praise him? Well, because according to his great mercy, he has caused us, meaning this is his doing, it's his initiative, this is something he enables to happen, he has caused us to be born again. That's what it means to be a Christian, to be born anew, to have new life, to have a new identity, a new start, a new perspective, a new view of the world. We are born again. Born again into what? Into a living hope. How? Through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So Peter says that we have a living hope, meaning our hope is alive because it's sourced in, it's rooted in a person who's alive, the risen Christ. Right? We don't hope in dead things or dying things. We have a living hope because we have a living Savior. So what Peter is saying here is that we can be sure right now in the present of our future hope because of what Jesus did in the past. It's a living hope. And Peter's going to tell us that hope should shape the way we live as exiles more than anything else, right? Because what we believe about the future shapes how we live right now. Now, there's three things that Peter tells us and answers about this living hope in our text today, three questions he answers. Number one, what is our living hope? Number two, why do we need it? And number three, how do we get it? How do we experience it in our daily life right now? So what is it? Why do we need it, and how do we get it? All right, so let's look first at what it is and how he describes it. In the original language, verses 3 through 12 actually make up this one long sentence. So it's this long run-on sentence. I think Peter apparently failed high school writing because he puts commas where there should be periods. Thankfully, our translators have put the periods in. But if you want to know what he does, he connects themes throughout this text. And you'll see that he connects them but then he'll have like parentheses and he'll talk about other stuff. If you want to know what the hope is, you got to dig a little bit to find out the fullness of what our hope is. And so let's dig a little bit. In verse 3, he says, we're born again into this living hope. Well, what is that hope? Look at verse 4. He says, you're born, in verse 4, to an inheritance that is imperishable, it's undefiled, it's unfading, it's kept in heaven for you. You're born again to an inheritance. So our hope somehow involves an inheritance. Now, we hear that word inheritance today, and we automatically think about money. We're like, sweet, I am going to be rich someday. My heavenly bank account is maxed out, and I will one day get all that stuff. That is awesome. Hallelujah. That's what we think about. When the original readers heard the word inheritance, they did not think about bank accounts. They did not have bank accounts. You know what they thought of? Land. They thought of property. What did God promise the Israelites as an inheritance? The land of Canaan. Remember, they had lived for 400 years as slaves in a land that didn't belong to them. Then they had wandered around for another 40 years in the wilderness in a land that didn't belong to them. What kept them going on that journey? A promised inheritance, a land to call their own, a home. What a wonderful promise, right? For wandering exiles, one day you'll be home. It's an amazing promise. And Peter's saying that part of our part of our living hope is that kind of inheritance, that we've got an inheritance coming our way. We've got one day a home to call our own coming our way. And he's like, nothing can mess it up. Did you see what he said about it? He said, it can never perish. It can never spoil. It can never fade. It's kept right there at the end of verse 4. It's kept in heaven for you. That means it's totally guaranteed. It's totally secure. Nothing and no one can ever forfeit our inheritance. Not even you. Not even me. We can't forfeit this great inheritance. Now, our hope is not just about inheriting a home. Peter's going to expand on what he means by our hope in the next verse, in verse 5, by using this broader word. He's going to use this word salvation. Look at verse 5. In verse 5. At the end of verse 4, he says, this inheritance is kept in heaven for you. Verse 5, who by God's power are being guarded through faith. So not only is the inheritance kept, but we are also kept. We are guarded through faith for what? For a salvation, but what about the salvation that's ready to be revealed when? In the last time. So we are not just inheriting a home, we're inheriting salvation, which is this umbrella word for all that God, all the blessings that God will give to his people. Deliverance from sin, deliverance from suffering, universal shalom, which is universal flourishing. Seeing him face to face, like we sang about today, dwelling in God's presence forever. That's salvation, right? And Peter says that salvation is ready. Like there's nothing left to do to prepare it. It's ready. All it has to do is be revealed. In other words, all that has to happen is for the curtain to be pulled back, right? And to be seen so that we can see it in full. When will that revelation, when will that pulling back of the curtain happen? In the last day. On the last day. Now, here's where we have to skip ahead in the run-on sentence. Because watch what Peter does. He connects this idea of revelation, something being revealed, which at the end of verse 5, he connects it with the end of verse 7. He brings up the same idea at the end of verse 7. There's some words, some other words in between in verse 6 and 7, but I want you to see the connection because he rounds out what our hope means there. Look at verse 7. I'll just read the first part of verse 7 quickly and then slow down for the end of it. He says, that so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it's tested by fire, may be found to result, so that your faith may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So that your faith may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. When will Jesus Christ be revealed? On the last day. And what will we receive from God when Jesus is revealed? Praise and glory and honor. I don't want you to miss the significance of that. God, on the last day, will praise you. God will give you glory. God will honor you. It's amazing. You may think to yourself, how can that be? I know my sin. I know how I've rejected God. I know how flaky I am. I know how undependable I am. How is it that God could give me praise, glory, and honor? Well, the gospel tells us that Jesus, on the cross, took everything that we deserve. Right? God's condemnation against sin, God's judgment against sin, against our guilt, against our flakiness, and then Jesus gave us everything he deserved. Praise, glory, and honor. So what this is saying is that at the revelation of Jesus Christ someday, we will get everything Jesus deserves. We will share in his inheritance. Romans 8 says we are joint heirs with Jesus. Like, we will get all the approval, all the honor, all the praise, all the glory that Jesus deserves. We will get unhindered fellowship with God himself, just like Jesus has. In short, we will get God. Right? That is our hope. That's our living hope. That is what salvation is. I want to show you how this works. 23 years ago, my father-in-law passed away. Died suddenly. And I only got a chance to know him for about a year and a half. I wish I'd gotten to know him much longer. But he passed away in 1994, and my father-in-law was an only child. He didn't have any siblings. Now, his father is still alive today. He lives here in Austin. He's 95 years old. Grandpa Thompson, we call him Grandpa T. He's wonderful. He still drives at 95, so look out there, because he's out there. Grandpa T is on the roads. Grandpa T only had one son, my father-in-law. So what that means is the only living blood descendants that he has left are my wife, her brother, and their kids, which is part of my kids. Now, every once in a while, over the past 10, 15 years, Grandpa T likes to pull us aside and make sure we're square on all the details about his stuff. Right? He'll show us like a filing cabinet, and he'll show us some account numbers, and we'll go through his will and stuff, and he'll just want to make sure we know in case something happens to him. A couple years ago, he said to my wife and I, "Hey, would you guys be interested in getting some little installments of my inheritance now to help with your daughter's college expenses?" And we're like, "You know what? We're going to need to pray about that." Okay, yes. The answer is yes. We will accept that now. Listen, my daughter is inheriting the blessing of being helped with some of her college expenses. Why? Because she's related to the only son, right? She's getting some of what belongs to him, not because of what she has done or what she deserves, but because she's related to him. See, we have a living hope. That's how our hope works. We have a future hope that is certain, that's living, not because of what we've done or what we deserve, but because we are related to, we are connected to the only Son. We get what he deserves. We get what belongs to him. That's our hope. Do you know what that means? That means that the feeling of transience that you have in this world will one day give way to permanence. When you're like, "Man, I'm home." Don't you want that? That means that the feeling of marginalization that you sometimes feel as an exile in this culture because of the crazy stuff that you believe will one day give way to honor and glory and praise. That means that the feeling that we all sometimes have of not fitting in, sometimes even in our own families, sometimes not even in our own skin, we're kind of like, I don't feel right. One day that will give away to the deepest sense of belonging. Where we're like, "Oh, this is where I belong." Right? That's our hope. That's salvation. Our hope, our living hope, is salvation and everything that comes with it. That's what it is. Now, why do we need it? Let's look at the next couple of verses. Why do we need hope? Why does Peter start this letter to these exiles talking about hope? Well, he does it because they're suffering. You see that in verse 6? They're suffering. They're going through trials. Look at verse 6. He says, "In this you rejoice." In what? Well, in the living hope, in the inheritance that can never fade or spoil or perish. In that, in the salvation that's ready to be revealed to you. In all that you rejoice. "Though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been grieved by various trials." So these Christians are living in a culture that is opposed to the gospel, which means they're facing persecution. They might be losing their jobs. They might be losing their freedoms. They might be losing, some of them, their lives. And so they are suffering. They're not suffering in spite of being Christians. They're suffering precisely because they are Christians. Right? And to go through suffering, to make it through suffering, you've got to have hope. Because if you don't, if you're suffering without hope, then you become like the prisoners in Shawshank Redemption. You either become brutal, you become a brutal person who's mad, angry, cruel, and you draw other people into your suffering, or you despair. You give up. You become despondent. You're like, or you're cynical, right? But if you have hope, I think something beautiful can happen right there in the middle of suffering. Look at verse 6 again. It gives us this interesting paradox in verse 6. It's a paradox that the world cannot seem to reconcile, and we have a hard time reconciling it too. I want you to see the paradox in verse 6. He says, "In this You rejoice. It's present tense. You are rejoicing right now. You're rejoicing. It's a strong word. It means overflowing with gladness. It means gladness and joy is just oozing out of you. You're rejoicing. But watch what is happening simultaneously. He says, though now, so something else is happening now, for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. And again, that's present tense. You are grieving. It's happening right now. Now again, grieving is a very strong word. It means intense sorrow. It's the word that's used of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane when it says that he was in agony. He was grieving. He was in deep sorrow. Those two things are happening together. So Peter is saying in verse 6, you are rejoicing and you are grieving at the same time. How is that even possible? How could deep joy and deep grief be compatible at all? How could you be overflowing with joy and overflowing with grief at the exact same time? How could that be possible? Well, the only way it would be possible is if your hope is not in your circumstances. See, because if your hope is in your circumstances, when things are going good, you're rejoicing. Things are going bad, you're grieving. It's either or. Your joy rises and falls on however your circumstances are going. The only way that I could have deep joy in the midst of deep grief is if I have a hope that transcends my circumstances, right? And here's the thing about suffering that you see in this text today. Suffering has a way of pulling back and revealing what our hope is. Do we have a true hope or do we have a false hope? Suffering, like unlike anything else, has a way of showing us that. Look at verse 7. Well, let me read the end of verse 6 and then verse 7. If necessary, you've been grieved by various trials so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So that word so that phrase so that is really important because it's a statement of purpose. It means that trials, this is good news, means trials are not random. Right? They're not without purpose. One of the purposes of trials in our life, not in every case, but in the way that Peter is talking about them here, is that they reveal where we're putting our hope. Like, do we have a true hope or a false hope? Suffering is just a stripping away of our false hopes. Because suffering can take away everything but Jesus. Everything that we're tempted to put our hope in that's not Jesus, suffering actually can strip it away. And so Peter uses this illustration of gold being refined in fire. You know, we know that when gold is melted in fire, the impurities rise to the top so that they can be skimmed off. And what does that leave the gold? It leaves it brighter, leaves it more pure, leaves it more genuine or more authentic. And so what Peter is saying is if we have false hopes in our life, and if we're living for things like money or family or success or marriage or whatever, or health, then those things, when they're taken away by suffering, we're destroyed, right? The fire of suffering just burns us up. But if we have a true hope, if we have a living hope, then the fire of suffering doesn't burn us up. What does it do? It just makes us shine brighter. It makes us shine brighter like pure gold. Meaning in the midst of suffering, we can actually be the kind of people who rejoice in the midst of suffering because our hope is in something imperishable, not in something that can burn up and be taken away. Now, let me just give you one example of how this might work. Let's take our health as an example. I think our health is a thing that many of us are tempted to put our hope in, especially in a city like Austin. Right? We like to eat right, get the kale chips instead of the potato chips with lunch. Don't do that. That's a terrible idea. Stick with the Lay's. But, you know, we like to take care of ourselves. We generally like, you know, exercise, eat right. Because we think, if I have my health, I have everything. But listen, I want to say something to you just from my personal experience this past week. My girls and I were looking back at some old family photos and family videos. And I saw some photos of me from like 10 or 15 years ago. right next to some photos from like recently. And I don't want to be overly dramatic here, but I am dying. It's a slow death. It's a slow decline, but when you see it right next to each other from just 10, 15 years ago, it's like, oh man. I'm not saying we shouldn't take care of our health. I think we should. I think it's really important. I'm just saying that my health cannot be my hope. Because if my hope is in my health, that is a dying hope. Because suffering can take it away. With something really quick, like an accident or a disease. Or with something relatively slow, like the slow burn of aging. It's not something I can put my hope in. It's a dying hope because it can be taken away. But if I have a living hope, the Lord Jesus and all that he promises in salvation, then nothing can take that away. Even if you take away my health, I still have something to live for, no matter what's going on in my life. And that's gold. That is gold. Hope is the answer to suffering because it gives us something certain to live for. Friedrich Nietzsche, philosopher who was not a Christian, you know what he said? He said, he who has a why to live can bear almost any how. He who has a why to live can bear almost any how and how they have to live. And by God's mercy, we've been born again into the most amazing why, right? Into a living hope. What is our hope? Salvation and everything that comes with it. Why do we need it? Because in this life, we will suffer to varying degrees simply because we're Christians. Lastly, how do you get it? How do you experience this hope in our day-to-day life? How can we, in our present reality, experience the hope that is certain in our life? And the simplest answer that this text gives us is the way we experience it is by faith. Like faith is a theme that runs through our text today. I don't know if you noticed it. The word is used three times. In verse 5, it says, God guards us for salvation through our faith in him. In verse 7, it says that we see that trials test the genuineness of our faith. In verse 9, we see that the outcome of our faith is the salvation of our souls. And so faith is the key component to how we experience our living hope in this life. And so the question is, what is faith? What do we mean by faith? What does that word mean? I think Peter gives the most beautiful description of faith in verse 8. Look what he says in verse 8, how he describes it. Verse 8. I'm amazed by this verse. He says to his readers, though you have not seen him, Jesus, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him, and you rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. Though you have not seen him, you love him. How can you love someone you've never seen before? That seems really difficult to me. I love my wife, but I can see her. I can touch her, I can hear her, I can smell her. Like my love relationship with my wife is rooted in this relationship that is visible and audible and touchable. And yet Peter describes faith here as that same kind of love relationship, but just without the visible part, without the audible, touchable part. And he praises his readers for their faith here. He's like, you guys haven't even seen Jesus, but you love him. You don't see him now, but you believe in him and you have so much joy in him. So Peter describes faith not as this cold mental assent to a body of information and in a set of facts, a doctrinal statement. He doesn't describe faith like that. He describes it as warm and living and relational, right? Faith is filled with love for a person, with joy in a person. But if you can't see the person, isn't that what we would call blind faith? That's the quandary we find ourselves in. What evidence do I have to put my trust, my faith in this person whom I've never seen, much less love this person? And that's when we have to say, oh yeah, remember who's writing this? Peter. Peter had evidence about Jesus firsthand. Peter had seen Jesus. Like Peter had looked into the eyes of Jesus, blazing with purpose, when Jesus said, "Follow me." Like Peter had seen the gentleness of Jesus with the outcast, with the sick, with the brokenhearted. Peter had seen the anger of Jesus at the self-righteous, at religious hypocrisy. Peter had seen the humility of Jesus as Jesus got down on his knees and washed the feet of the disciples, including Peter's feet. Peter had seen the hurt in Jesus' eyes when he denied him 3 times and said, "I don't even know that guy." And then Jesus looked right at him. Peter saw Jesus stretch out his arms on the cross and die, but Peter also saw Jesus alive again on the beach, restoring him to fellowship, restoring him to purpose. Peter had seen Jesus ascend into heaven and promise he was coming back. See, Peter had seen Jesus and he loved him. That's why he can say to us, love him. Even if you haven't seen him, you can love him because Jesus is alive. Jesus is alive. Peter had witnessed firsthand his glory, his majesty, and he said, "I trust him. I stake my life on him, and you can do it too." So he eagerly calls us to faith in Jesus, and here's why. Because faith in Jesus is the key to unlocking a present experience of our future hope. The only way we can unlock our hope in Jesus now in the present, our future hope now in the present, is to have faith or trust in this one we cannot see. That means you and I have to nourish, to seek to grow our faith in Jesus. If we're ever going to put our hope in Jesus instead of other things, we've got to nourish this hope in Jesus. How do we do it? A couple things by way of application. First is this. If you want to grow your faith in Jesus so that you would hope in him, meditate on him as he's revealed in the scriptures. Like, spend time looking at him specifically in the Gospels, which are the eyewitness accounts of those who saw him, knew him, his life, death, resurrection. If you are not a Christian, maybe you're here and you're just investigating, "I'm not sure what I believe about Jesus." I would just encourage you to look at him in Matthew and Mark and Luke and John. What's he like? What's he say? What's he do? I think as you begin to meditate on and look at him, you can't help but love him. All right? Secondly, to grow your faith in him, I would say this: gaze upon the gospel. Like, keep gazing upon the good news that God saves sinners through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Did you notice that in verse 12, that last verse that was read today, that it says that right at the end of our text today, look at it. It says, angels long to look into the gospel. Angels, these heavenly beings who are way smarter.